when the defendant provokes the incident, he loses the right to self-defense. You cannot claim self-defense against a danger you create.
Kyle shot Joseph Rosenbaum to stop a threat to his person. And I'm glad he shot him, because if Joseph Rosenbaum had got that gun, I don't for a minute believe he wouldn't have used it against somebody else.
You're listening to some of the final arguments delivered by the prosecution and defense during the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. Now, there's no dispute about the basic facts of this case. In the summer of 2020, Rittenhouse, who was then 17 years old, left his home in Antioch, Illinois. He drove across state lines to Wisconsin, transporting along with himself an AR-style semi-automatic rifle. After crossing state lines with this weapon, Rittenhouse shot and killed two people. And he shot and injured a third person. Now, it's easy to see why an outsider would assume this is a non-controversial case, one where the clarity of such key facts would leave little room for disagreement and would mean the case barely received media attention. Instead, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse on five felony charges, including first-degree intentional homicide, has captivated the American public for weeks. The trial is much less about what happened and far more about why. Context, motivation, precipitating and mitigating factors, all are core considerations for the jury now deciding Rittenhouse's fate. The trial has never been about who, what, when, or how. This is a trial about why. And that means the jury's decision will be less about Rittenhouse and more about America. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and that's where we start on The Takeaway. Here with me now is Paul Butler, the Albert Brick Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's also the author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Welcome, Professor Butler. How are you?
I'm doing great, Melissa. It's great to be back on The Takeaway.
It's always nice to have you, even in a tough moment like this. So let's just start with the oddity that this is a case where the defendant is white, the victims are white, and yet somehow this is a case about race. How'd that happen?
This case grew out of a protest inspired by the Movement for Black Lives about Kenosha police shooting an African-American person. There were protests many nights, and on one of those nights, Mr. Rittenhouse showed up with an AK-15 and shot three people, killing two of them and blowing the arm off another person. Melissa, as this was happening, the crowd turned on Mr. Rittenhouse after they'd seen his acts of violence. And Mr. Rittenhouse went to the police with his gun in the air, the crowd shouting, "He just shot three people." The police told Mr. Rittenhouse, 17-year-old white man, "Make sure you don't get tear gassed and go home." It's impossible to imagine a young 17-year-old black man approaching the cops with a gun, crowd screaming, "He just shot three people," and the police telling that young man, "Go home." And so to a lot of people, this is a case about equal justice under the law.
To be fair, the prosecution, the DA, did in fact charge Rittenhouse, though. I mean, it's not as though, you know, obviously if we remember back a decade now with the case of George Zimmerman, who was also told to go home after shooting and killing someone, in that case, a teenager, Trayvon Martin. And it took an entire social movement to get Mr. Zimmerman even arrested and charged. In this case, there was eventually an arrest, there was eventually a charge, but at least in sort of reviewing how this case is being covered in media, how people are responding to it in social media, it does seem that there's a real possibility that Mr. Rittenhouse will be told to go home at the end of this jury deliberation as well.
So I do think it's a sign of progress that this case was brought at all. It's far from a slam dunk for the prosecution. Mr. Rittenhouse has a credible defense. In his closing statement, the prosecutor told a compelling story about a reckless 17-year-old who took a semi-assault weapon to a protest, spoiling for a fight. And I thought the best line of the closing argument was when the prosecutor said hundreds of people were out in the street experiencing chaos and violence, but the only person who killed anyone was the defendant, Kyle Rittenhouse. But of course, the defense has an answer, and that's why this is going to be, I think, a difficult case for the jury. The defense really went after the first person who Mr. Rittenhouse killed, a man who seemed to be experiencing a mental health crisis. And the defense said that that man attacked Mr. Rittenhouse, tried to get his gun. Mr. Rittenhouse's second victim attacked Mr. Rittenhouse with a skateboard. And the third victim had a gun. And so Mr. Rittenhouse is claiming self-defense. His argument is that he faced deadly force, and under the law, he was allowed to use deadly force in return in order to save his own life.
What should we expect that the jury is talking about? But based on what you know about juries and how they deliberate, will race be center? Will they actually put race on the, you know, kind of on the table and have a conversation about it? Or will it simply be lurking in the background as they are as they're deliberating?
So, Melissa, in this case, the jury was selected in a day, and we can compare that to the three-week selection process in the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, and also about 3 weeks to pick that jury in Georgia for the killers of Ahmaud Arbery. So there's not as much information about the jurors in the Rittenhouse case. Reportedly, one is African-American out of the 12 who will decide the fate of the case. In a lot of criminal trials that have come about during the Black Lives Matter era, race is the reason that people are interested in these cases. It's why they're so high profile. The irony is that race rarely comes up in the courtroom, and the Rittenhouse case is no exception. I don't think race was brought up once. All of the principal parties are white. We know that the jurors have deliberated one full day. That suggests that this isn't a simple case. Just based on the law, they're facing, Mr. Rittenhouse is facing long, complicated charges. Melissa, sometimes jurors go into that room where they deliberate right after they've been instructed by the judge, and they kind of look at each other and they have a sense of what's happening, what they think the verdict is. This doesn't seem to be one of those cases just based on the fact that the jurors have already deliberated a whole day.
Which was, their deliberation is now longer than it took to select them as a jury. Is that right?
That's right.
I'm wondering, you know, obviously the judge, Bruce Schrader, has made headlines a lot, but presumably the jury is not paying attention to or don't know about those headlines. But is there anything about the judge's behaviors, actions, instructions in court that could have an effect on how the jury deliberates over the next hours or days?
During the trial, prosecutors fought to get in evidence that the judge wouldn't allow. And this evidence presents a different picture of Rittenhouse than the Boy Scout who was at these protests to render medical aid that the defense portrayed. Among the videos that the prosecutor wanted the jurors to see is Mr. Rittenhouse beating up a teenage girl who'd gotten into a fight with his sister, and another video where Mr. Rittenhouse is observing people who he thinks are looting a CVS drugstore, and Mr. Rittenhouse says, "Man, I wish I had my AK-15 because I would shoot them." So that's very probative evidence in a sense, but you can understand the judge's concern that that might be too much for the jury. It might prejudice them. The judge has made a number of rulings that favor the defense. Because this is a political trial, some people have questioned whether the judge is tipping the scales in favor of the defendant. But there are some acts he's taken that he does in every trial. So he got a lot of attention for not allowing the people who Mr. Rittenhouse killed to be called victims. But the truth is, the judge does that in every self-defense case that he presides over because he thinks victim is something that the jury has to determine.
I have struggled with this case a bit because Mr. Rittenhouse is 18 and was 17 at the time of killing these individuals. And I guess it is hard to take race out of something. I mean, that, I just simply don't even quite believe in that idea of taking it out. But I do have to say, you know, just in the coverage I've done over the years and the research I've done over the years, we are supposed to think about young people, and young is still 17, 18 years old, a bit differently in the criminal legal system. Do you have any advice for how we should be contemplating and thinking about Mr. Rittenhouse's age?
I think we should think about adjudication and sentencing differently. So adjudication is what's happening now. It's the process of deciding whether Mr. Rittenhouse did it, whether Mr. Rittenhouse is a murderer. And if the jury convicts him, then he'll go on to a sentencing phase. And in notorious cases that inflame passion, sometimes the instinct is to throw the defendant under the jail. And we know that based on the values of the movement for Black lives, those kinds of tough sentencing practices always end up impacting African-Americans and Latinx people, Native Americans, more adversely. And so if Mr. Rittenhouse is found guilty, and that's a big if, I think that it's important to understand that this was a young person. As spiritual people say, God isn't through with them yet. Mm. At the same time, he took two lives and forever altered the life of the other person who he shot. So the same judge who's presided over the trial, if there's a conviction, will have to decide what are Mr. Rittenhouse's just deserts, what it means to bring justice in a case like this.
Paul Butler is Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Butler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Melissa, it's always a pleasure.
I stand on faith that God has given me, that even if he doesn't meet with me, I'm praying that he has heard my mother's words, my brother's words, and my words, and my family's words. I'm just asking him to hear from God. This is not a political decision. This is a moral decision.
That was Antoinette Jones, sister of Julius Jones, speaking with the Oklahoman earlier this week. Now, she was talking about Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt's pending decision over whether to commute her brother's death sentence. Her brother's execution is scheduled for Thursday. Governor Stitt has delayed his decision for 2 weeks. Now, it follows a vote earlier this month by the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board, which recommended that Jones's sentence be commuted to life in prison with the possibility of parole. As Antoinette mentioned, the governor has not met with Jones's family ahead of the scheduled execution. Julius Jones has always maintained his innocence of the 1999 murder of businessman Paul Howell. And despite a wealth of evidence supporting his claim, he is moving closer each hour to being executed by the state of Oklahoma. Kelly Masters is an attorney based in Oklahoma, and she served as part of Julius Jones's legal delegation at his commutation hearing in September. Was actually skeptical of Jones's innocence until she took a closer look at the evidence. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
So talk to me about your skepticism about the Jones case.
Well, I've been an attorney in Oklahoma for 21 years. I have never necessarily been anti-death penalty. I've always been very much a law and order person who believes that we have the best justice system on the planet in this country. And I essentially always believed that Oklahoma basically got it right. Although there have certainly been exonerations over the years, I wanted to believe that this case was heard by a jury. It was heard by reviewed by multiple appellate judges. And at the end of the day, the conviction remained. And it sounded like a horrific case, just reading about the details of the murder, with basically a carjacking gone wrong and a father dying in front of his sister and his two children. And it was just a devastating case. And I was contacted initially to write a letter on behalf of Julius Jones to our governor, Governor Stitt. And initially, I almost declined, thinking, well, you know, why should I get involved in something like this? It's already been tried and appealed, and here we are. But something in me really compelled me to take a closer look. So I started digging into the facts of the case. I started reviewing every transcript, every piece of evidence. And I think the thing that really opened my eyes was at trial, when the prosecution rested their case, the defense attorneys, who were young public defenders at the time, just simply stood up and said, "The defense rests." And there was so much information that the jury never heard and never got to consider. And that's when I knew I really, really needed to dig in and know more. And I wanted to even meet Julius before I wrote a letter. And then I decided I couldn't just write a letter. I wanted to really be an advocate and do all I could to make sure Oklahoma got this right.
I want to begin by acknowledging what you said about Mr. Howell, who was killed, that the facts of that case are horrifying, and that his family, as his survivors, have every right to feel desperately sad and angry that that he was taken from them. And as we acknowledge that reality, also the realities that you are offering to us about the possibility that there could be a miscarriage of justice in the case of Julius Jones, I'm wondering, as you have watched this move forward, and we've only, we have not followed the case for as long as you have, obviously, but we have been following it for a few months. And I have to say, I'm surprised to find us here the day before the execution is set to take place, given that there have been two recommendations by the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board that would at least be staying the execution, right? It doesn't mean that Mr. Jones would be going home, but it would be leaving open possibilities.
Exactly. And I was part of the delegation that spoke on Mr. Jones' behalf in September, and it was a 3-1 vote by the Pardon and Parole Board, and the board is tasked with reviewing all the evidence, all the circumstances of the conviction, looking at things the jury didn't see, including confessions by Christopher Jordan, the co-defendant, that he actually was the one that murdered Paul Howell and had pinned it on Julius, and had admitted even that he planted the murder weapon in Julius's house. None of that was heard by the jury. The Pardon and Parole Board looked at everything objectively to make sure that we're getting it right. And not just at the commutation hearing, but also last month at the clemency hearing, which is an even more robust hearing, they voted the same way. They voted, and now that they came down on the side of innocence, which is personally where I've landed after looking at everything objectively, they just expressed there are so many doubts in this case that there's no way we should move forward with execution. This really, of all circumstances where you look to commute a sentence, this would be one of them. And honestly, I had held out hope because of those two strong recommendations to the governor by his appointed pardon and parole board. And yet at this hour, I'm very concerned that we are marching towards execution.
I want to be as generous and fair as I can with the choice that the governor is making here. Can you help us in two ways? One, what are the choices that the governor has, right? So what things might the governor be able to do here? Can he stay the execution but, leave for more trial? Does he have to actually, absolutely absolve Mr. Jones? Sort of, I'm wondering what his options are. And then also what you think he's using as criteria for making the decision.
So first of all, the process in Oklahoma is this. Once all of the appeals have run, which they have in this case, they did years ago, and I might point out that on appeal, appellate courts are limited to the record created and preserved at trial, and the bar for reversal is very high. And so it sadly, even with all the evidence in this case of Julius's innocence, it does not surprise me that the limited record never got a fair review. That's what the Pardon and Parole Board is in place to do, to actually make sure and ensure that we don't make mistakes. And so the board has voted twice in favor of once in favor of commutation, meaning a lesser sentence, and they recommended life with a possibility of parole. The second hearing, they recommended clemency, and also made the same recommendation, meaning the recommendation to the governor was to spare Julius's life and commute his sentence to something lesser. So the governor can stay the execution. He can actually ask for a reprieve, meaning the execution is simply delayed to give him more time to review the case. He could do that. He could accept the Pardon and Parole Board's recommendation of life with a possibility of parole. And he has followed the board's recommendation in the vast majority of cases that they've recommended clemency in. He could choose to commute to life without parole. He could choose to commute to life with time served and you're released for time served. Julius could walk out immediately, or he could be up for parole in a matter of months or years, or he could be just sent to prison for life. Or the decision that I think the governor is weighing on or leaning towards is just allowing the execution to proceed according to the judgment entered against him. I wish I could say what the governor is thinking in this case. It boggles my mind that after the two strong recommendations and all of the hearings that have been held, that he would actually go against that and allow the execution to proceed with such doubt remaining in this case. I wish I knew. I really, truly wish I knew what the governor was thinking in rejecting this, potentially rejecting this recommendation.
I guess we will all soon learn. Kelly Masters, attorney based in Oklahoma, our thoughts are with you, with the families of both Mr. Howell and Mr. Jones over the course of the next 24 hours. Thank you.
Thank you.
Because we think of The Takeaway as a conversation, and you're part of our community, I just want to take a moment and be very honest with you. Now, we've been covering the case of Julius Jones for months here on the show, and we've talked with members of his family and with some of the advocates who've been fighting for Julius's life. We have not talked with any family members of Paul Howell, the man that Jones is convicted of killing. And I can imagine as this execution is coming closer that they have a variety of difficult feelings. I also want to point out that I'm not a lawyer and that I have not reviewed all the details, all the documents of this long and complicated case. And so I do not know for certain if Julius Jones is guilty of the crime for which he is set to be killed tomorrow. I don't. Here's what I do know. I know the district attorney who charged and convicted Julius Jones has had a full third of his cases overturned due to prosecutorial misconduct. I do know that to date, 10 people who were sentenced to die in murder cases in Oklahoma have been exonerated. And I do know that Oklahoma City police officers have erected barricades around the governor's mansion because Governor Kevin Stitt has still refused to act to stop this execution. And that's despite the fact that the Parole and Probation Board in the past several months has recommended both commutation and clemency. So let me be clear. I am not sure that Julius Jones is innocent. But far more important, the state of Oklahoma is not certain that Julius Jones is guilty. Now, back in October, as we grappled with the reality of the Jones case, the takeaway, we took a deep dive into the practices of the death penalty in this country. And look, across our long history, at different points, we've had various protocols of death. We've used public hangings, firing squads, gas chambers, the electric chair. All, at various points, have been legal methods of execution. But since 1977, nearly 90% of all executions have used lethal injections. That's how Julius Jones is set to be killed tomorrow. And for years, lethal injections have been presented as a more humane alternative to previous methods of execution. But during our deep dive, we talked to Sam Spital of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he helped us to understand that lethal injections are not a humane alternative.
In fact, as Justice Sotomayor has noted in a number of dissenting opinions, there's powerful evidence that lethal injection in many cases risks essentially torturing someone to death, but they are, because of the paralytic effects of one of the drugs, unable to in any way show what's happening to them. So it is really this ultimate form of torture that no one else can see. So it appears to others that this is somehow an anesthetic, almost medical event, and it looks peaceful when in fact the person who is being executed is being tortured to death. And then you have very serious risks about maladministration of drugs. Oftentimes the people involved in executions do not have proper training. So we've seen a number of indisputably botched executions. And where it's clear that the person who was executed was tortured to death. The method remains, dare I say, popular in many places because it creates this false sense of somehow the state is not doing what it's actually doing, which is taking a human life. And taking a human life, there's no way, however it appears, to make what is actually happening anesthetic or painless process.
And so here we are, the day before a man we are not sure is guilty is sentenced to die by a method that we know is not humane. This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
In 2015, Sandra Bland was pulled over for a traffic stop on the outskirts of Houston, Texas, and she was on her way to the grocery store. She just relocated to Texas from Chicago to take a job at her alma mater, Prairie View A&M University, a historically black college. Bland was violently arrested and taken to the Waller County Jail.
No, you don't have the right.
Step out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car!
And then
I will light you up. Get out!
Wow.
She needed $515 to make bail, but she told jailers she was broke. Jail staff didn't put her on suicide watch even after she told them she was depressed and had tried taking her own life the previous year. 3 days later, she was found dead in her cell, and authorities ruled her death a suicide. Now, the Bland family received a $1.9 million settlement in their wrongful death lawsuit, along with an agreement from the Waller County Jail to increase guard training. The next year, the Texas legislature passed a reform bill called the Sandra Bland Act. But despite awareness of these issues and reforms, conditions in jails for incarcerated people in Texas are still troubling, to say the least. In 2020, the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, which regulates county jails, reported 124 deaths, the highest count since the agency began tracking them in 2009. Now, if someone dies in their county jails, Texas sheriffs are subject to investigation by the Texas Rangers. That's the detective arm of the state police. The Texas Observer, a nonprofit investigative newsroom, reviewed more than 400 Texas Ranger investigations of jail deaths over the past decade. And we talked to one of the reporters of that investigation. It's titled Locked Up and Left to Die.
My name is Mike Barajas. I'm a staff writer at the Texas Observer.
In their investigation, the Texas Observer found that of the more than 1,100 people who have died in jail in Texas since 2010, the majority were pre-trial detainees, people like Sandra Bland, who were never convicted of their alleged crime.
They have been accused, maybe charged with some sort of criminal offense, but they haven't been convicted of it. In the eyes of the law, they are legally innocent. Part of the reason pre-trial detention has risen across the country is because of the increased reliance by judges, prosecutors, to keep people in jail if they can't pay bail. Being poor is the mechanism that keeps them in jail, ultimately.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, many localities saw backups in the court system for a range of reasons, like lockdowns or unavailable judges or defense lawyers. So I asked Mike if he saw the jail system in Texas getting worse during the pandemic.
If jails are already dealing with overcrowding issues and maybe understaffing issues, or they're dealing with the challenges of people in psychiatric, you know, mental health crisis, and substance use issues. COVID just added another, you know, huge challenge that led to like a just general backup in the system. Courts weren't operating the way that they had been before. Cases weren't moving at the pace that they were before. And so one interesting thing that you started to see in Texas and in other parts of the country during COVID was advocates, civil rights lawyers, people with incarcerated family members and friends really pushing for jails to depopulate, to let more people out on, you know, non-monetary conditions of release, such as some sort of court-ordered monitoring or something, and citing COVID as a reason. And some local sheriffs and judges really responding to that and actually trying to do what they could to try to prioritize, you know, people with low-level charges because they recognize the threat of COVID inside of an incarcerated setting and how quickly that would spread and could impact the larger community, right? What we also saw in Texas, though, was a conservative backlash to that. The governor here, Governor Greg Abbott, among a number of different executive orders that he's issued that really tests bounds of executive power here in the state. One of those orders was essentially making it harder for certain people to get out of jail pretrial, making it so that, you know, certain people maybe in the past that have been accused of violent offenses, they have to pay cash bail to get out. A judge wouldn't be allowed to set some sort of non-monetary condition of release for them. And so the Republican-dominated legislature here effectively made that law, you know, several months later, a new bail law here in the state that makes it so that in all likelihood, more people are going to be held in jail pre-trial because they can't pay whatever dollar amount was set for their freedom.
Now, the Observer reviewed 415 reports of death by the Texas Rangers. And just kind of looking at the numbers, the claim here is that there are about 30% of these 415 deaths in custody were by suicide. Another 42% were by natural causes. So that's, you know, obviously and then another 14 accidental. So that is like the overwhelming majority. The claim of the Texas Rangers is that there was either suicide, natural causes, or accidental. But these are all individuals in the custody, right, of the Texas jails. So can you help us to understand how suicide or accident leads to death at these rates, and what it means to say someone died of natural causes while in custody?
So with the suicide portion of that, what you see pretty frequently in these reports that you just cited that we went through, these state police investigations into jail deaths, it's a suicide. What's often demonstrated when you go back and look at, you know, how staff treated somebody, how often they were checked, what precautions they did or didn't take, there's a remarkable tolerance for suicide inside these facilities often. So the red flags could be as obvious as somebody having attempted to take their own life in that facility, you know, during that stint of incarceration. And for whatever reason, jailers don't put them on increased monitoring, don't have any added precautions, leave them alone for long periods of time. And then ultimately, that person takes their own life. Those are situations that we saw reflected in these reports. You know, on the suicide front, we also saw how the regulations that are in place in Texas weren't followed. You know, if somebody is flagged as suicidal by state law, their jailers are supposed to check on them at least every 30 minutes. These investigations show that that's often not done. And sometimes jailers will even lie about checking on people more frequently than they really did. And videotape shows that they lied. On the accidental front, we saw this sometimes where people might be arrested for drug-related offense. This is a situation I saw. Somebody might be arrested for obstructing evidence in a case by like swallowing the drugs that police thought they caught them with because they're trying to avoid getting into any more trouble. And that person, despite their deteriorating health, which, you know, would reasonably be linked to like a drug overdose, you know, they're taken to a jail setting anyway and just left to sort of deteriorate until they die instead of taken to a hospital. Those are some of the accidents that we saw. Mm-hmm. On the natural causes front, I think we saw a lot of things that were labeled natural causes where it looked like the treatment and conditions of incarceration either exacerbated like an underlying medical condition or pretty directly attributed to them dying. We dig into some instances in our story. We write about people who had heart conditions and said they thought they were having heart attacks and were trying to alert jail staff and writing letters and pleading for help and ultimately died. And the medical examiner says it was natural causes death due to a heart attack they likely suffered while they were in jail. And so a lot of the deaths that fall under that natural causes umbrella, there are a lot of red flags that we saw pointing to them being preventable deaths. In a lot of the instances that we looked at, nobody's really held responsible. I think that was one of the really troubling things, that you could have a lot of documentation about what went wrong. Officials are aware of it. You can see sort of the callous disregard for somebody's humanity or dignity, and yet consequences didn't follow. You know, I talked before about instances where jailers, there's evidence that they lied about how frequently they were checking on somebody. That's chargeable. That's a chargeable felony offense in Texas for tampering with government documents. When jailers are charged, which is very infrequently, like kind of across law enforcement, but when they are charged, it's usually that, because it seems to be the kind of most standard way they can get caught. But even, you know, where we saw that happening, there were a number of instances where people weren't charged or weren't even, or the case wasn't even presented to a grand jury to determine whether they should be charges. So it's a lot of red flags on paper, but the system as a whole, we didn't see major reforms or changes in light of any of the horrific circumstances that we document in the story. For the most part, there might have been a lawsuit or there might be a charge against an officer that, if it goes anywhere, which a lot of them don't, might just result in, you know, a deferred adjudication probation agreement, essentially, and no jail time. So on paper, there's a lot of checks and safeguards. In reality, you know, a lot falls through the cracks.
Obviously, one of the few names of someone who died in police custody in Texas that many Americans may know is the name of Sandra Bland. Mm-hmm. After her death, were there any reforms to this system?
Yeah, there were. And for this story, we talked to the attorney who represented her family in their lawsuit after her death, but also helped negotiate reforms that the state ultimately ended up passing in a bill that was named after Sandra Bland. The lawyer talked about how important it was for the family that it wasn't just a lawsuit settlement, that it wasn't just a number, a monetary settlement, that changes had to be made. And so one of those changes was really better documentation of the conditions that we're talking about. For our investigation, we looked at more than 400 state police investigations into jail deaths in the state. A lot of those wouldn't have happened before the Sandra Bland Act took effect in 2018. That law, one of the reforms was that there had to be an independent investigation into jail deaths, that sheriffs effectively were not allowed to investigate themselves anymore. And thus you have better documentation in some ways of the conditions inside these facilities when things go wrong and what the challenges are and what the problems are and how staff are treating people. But again, that doesn't necessarily change the conditions inside these facilities if there's not somebody in power who then does anything about it. So yes, Sandra Bland's death led to some really important reforms in this state, as I think, you know, her family's attorney and the family would probably acknowledge. It's that those reforms don't go far enough to change the problems that her tragic death like highlighted. There has to be more action than just the reforms that were passed by the state to really get at some of the deeper issues inside these facilities.
And is there a clear sense of what those actions are that are necessary to create lasting and meaningful reform?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different options. I mean, I think like a lot of reform on the criminal justice front, it's a lot of different organizing happening at the same time. So like we just talked about how the Sandra Bland Act was pretty crucial. One thing that state lawmakers here have been warned about by advocates, civil rights attorneys, and even, you know, an independent like state watchdog agency that has looked at state jail regulators here and how they perform and how they operate. It's just that the regulations are good on paper, but they don't ensure safe conditions behind bars because, you know, the regulations that exist here are pretty vague. They're not enforced all that often. The state commission that is there to inspect and enforce these minimum state standards is pretty toothless. They're on a shoestring budget. I mean, I think that they have three or four investigators at any given time or inspectors to go out and look at conditions in jails and report back and flag violations. That's three or four people tasked with, you know, monitoring more than 230 jails across this huge state, responsible for inspecting conditions that affect, you know, more than 100,000 people probably at any given time in lockup in local jails in Texas, not to mention the like million or so people that churn through these facilities on any given year. And so there's a regulation side of this that needs to be addressed. The legislature has been told about it. Like I said, instead they made it so that more people would be inside of these facilities in all likelihood, but did little to look at the conditions inside of them. These facilities are mostly operated by local sheriffs, local elected law enforcement officials. So that plays a pretty key role. There's been a lot of discussion in progressive and abolitionist circles in recent years about the role that reform prosecutors can play, you know, like progressive prosecutors in the mold of Larry Krasner in Philly and some others that have been elected around the country. There's been less attention on reform sheriffs and what they can do, but you've seen certain races across the country where jail conditions have become, you know, a big issue for the public. Those races have started to focus a little bit more on jail conditions and thus, you know, reform candidates that are willing to come in and clean up shop. So I think there's a lot of different levels where reforms are needed and a lot of opportunity on all those fronts.
Mike Barajas is staff writer for the Texas Observer. Thank you so much for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Okay, y'all, that's the show, and it was pretty heavy. So I want to leave you with another transformative takeaway. Now, today I'm showing a little love to the Louisiana Board of Pardons. Earlier this week, they voted unanimously to pardon Homer Plessy. Yeah, that Homer Plessy, the litigant in the 1896 Supreme Court case, Plessy v. Ferguson. So pretty obviously, this is a posthumous pardon. But still, it matters. A few weeks ago, during our deep dive on passing, Dorian Warren and I talked about Homer Plessy, a Creole of color who openly challenged racial segregation on the trains by purchasing a first-class ticket and sitting in a car designated for whites only. When the conductor instructed Mr. Plessy to move out of the whites-only car, Plessy was arrested and later convicted of violating the Separate Car Act of 1890. Mr. Plessy's appeal then went to the Supreme Court, and in 1896, the court decided in Plessy v. Ferguson that it was legal to establish separate but equal accommodations. Separate but equal was considered constitutional policy until the court's decision in 1954's Brown v. Board of Education finally affirmed that separate is inherently unequal. Homer Plessy died in 1925, decades before Brown v. Board, and is still recorded as having been convicted of violating the law. But this is about to change. Keith Plessy, a descendant of Homer Plessy, and Phoebe Ferguson, a descendant of Mr. Ferguson, jointly founded the Plessy and Ferguson Foundation. They have worked for years to advance racial justice and understanding and to rectify the legal wrongs against Homer Plessy. And last week, they succeeded in convincing the Louisiana Board of Pardons to recommend a posthumous pardon for Homer Plessy. Governor John Bel Edwards of Louisiana is expected to make the decision official with his signature in coming days. If you can think of anyone, living or gone, who deserves a shout out in our transformative takeaway segment, please call us and let us know. You can call 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. We always love to hear from you. Now, if you missed anything, don't miss anything ever again. Be a subscriber to our podcast. You can download it wherever you get your audio. And when you do that, be sure you subscribe, you share, and you give us a like. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. I'm in New York City, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back tomorrow.